All rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning. Our first case is 11-1076, Bruce R. Hudak et al. Versus ThyssenKrupp Materials. For the appellant, is it Mr. Mash?
May it please the court, my name is Cliff Mash. I represent the appellant in this matter, ThyssenKrupp Materials. With me at the table is Greg Geis, who was trial counsel from Remminger on this matter. At this time, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. The appeal before this court focuses on a decision from the 8th District Court of Appeals, which reviewed a trial court's granting of summary judgment under 274501 as amended in 2005. The trial court granted summary judgment finding no genuine issue of material fact and that the plaintiff could not establish the criteria in order to establish a cause of action under any of the subsections of that statute. On appeal, the 8th District Court of Appeals looked at Mr. Hudak's assignment as it related to subsection A of 2745.01. And the court made two findings, which we request that this court review closely. First, the 8th District Court of Appeals determined that the statutory definition of the phrase substantial certainty, as it says, set forth in subsection B, was the product of an unintended scrivener's error by the legislature. And as a result, the trial court did not give deference to the limited definition afforded that term by the General Assembly. The Court of Appeals, in its analysis, intimated that it must mean something less than absolute. Secondarily, the court also made a determination that the determination of whether an employer had harbored the belief that injury was substantially certain to occur was an objective test, not a subjective test. Otherwise, the court did not need to look at the subjective mindset of the employer. Rather, the court would apply a objective, reasonable employer test. What would the reasonable employer believe acting under the circumstances as this employer did as to whether it believed injury was substantially certain to occur?
Counsel, can I ask you a question as to whether we're in 2745.01B or C? Because C, there seemed to be some argument back and forth in the briefs because the 8th District didn't address it. If we're under C, the analysis is with regard to the safety guard and does not putting something in place constitute removal of a safety guard? And if we're in B, we're talking about the substantial certainty. Can you help me with that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. At the trial level, appellant argued for a finding on the intentional tort under both sections of 274501. It would argued for a finding under subsection A and B, and it separately argued for a finding under subsection C. The trial court rejected all arguments. Appellant Hudak at that point in time then appealed the matter before the Court of Appeals, asserting arguments under 274501 A and B, and separately asserting arguments under subsection C. The 8th District Court of Appeals only addressed Mr. Hudak's argument with respect to subsection A. And it's our position that, because the court was before the court and the court chose not to accept it, there's an assumption that the court rejected that, as did the trial court.
So, Mr. Mash, if we were to find in your favor, would we need to remand the case to the Court of Appeals to deal with the other issue?
I think it's presumed that the Court of Appeals rejected the argument because it chose not to address it. It didn't even indicate that it was moot by virtue of its finding. And we separately submit that under no circumstances can the facts of this case be reasonably perceived to raise an issue as it relates to subsection C.
Subsection, look at subsection C as the VSSR, the idea of safety feature not being put in place. Is that how you're reading it?
No, Your Honor. Subsection C is very specific as to what circumstances it addresses. Subsection C addresses two sets of situations. One is where there's a deliberate removal, by the employer of an equipped safety guard. and secondarily deals with situations where there's a deliberate misrepresentation of the existence of a toxic substance. In this case, there are no facts that the employer in this case deliberately removed any existing safety guard.
So this is not coterminous with the idea of the VSSR?
That the VSSR finding is correct, Your Honor, has nothing to do with the findings of this case. The VSSR finding related to a determination that the equipment was operating down an aisle that didn't have a means of which the employee could get away from the equipment. That was the finding. There was no finding in the VSSR that there was a removal of any safety equipment by the employer.
So you're saying C is a subsection of the type of VSSR that would be put into play?
Well, I think subsection C is indicative of the compromise that took place when the legislature generated 274501. As this court recognized in Kaminsky and Stettler, the primary purpose of 274501 was to significantly curtail the old substantially certain standard that this court had recognized was causing a lot of litigation and had been inappropriately applied in a number of facts. Subsection C creates an easier cause of action than had existed under the prior common law. Under subsection C, if there are facts which reflect that the employer deliberately removes a safety guard or misrepresents the existence of toxic substances, the employee is entitled to a rebuttable presumption that that act was done with the purpose of causing injury. So it actually creates, in a limited number of circumstances, an easier cause of action than had existed in the common law before the legislature enacted 274501. It's indicative, in my mind, of a compromise in what the General Assembly allowed when it generated this legislation.
You mentioned Kaminsky, and, of course, the Court of Appeals did discuss that to a degree. Have we not already decided this issue in the Kaminsky case?
Your Honor, it's our position you, in fact, have, because when this court analyzed the constitutionality of 274501, this court looked specifically at subsection B, and in examining the language of subsection B, this court discerned that the legislative intent in enacting 274501 under A was to limit that cause of action to only those situations where there is specific intent to cause injury. So this court, in my opinion, this court, in fact, did resolve the issue. And this court clearly looked at the same language that the 8th District Court of Appeals concluded was a Scrivener's error.
Well, if we've already decided the case, Mr. Mash, what is there left for us to write if this court has directed what the law is in this case?
Well, in one of the issues, to be perfectly frank, I think this court can affirm the trial court's judgment based on Kaminsky and Stettler alone. One of the arguments that appellant has raised in its brief, none of the appellants supporting amici have really tried to defend the appellate court's determination of a Scrivener's error. What they've argued in the alternative is, well, even though that may be wrong, 274501A really has two ways of proving an intentional tort, and they must mean something different.
Well, if our role is to write a rule of law applying this statute, and we've already done it, are we really dealing with an errant decision of a court of appeals, and you want us to correct an error?
Well,
is that court of appeals not following the law that we've done? What is your argument?
Well, my argument, number one, is, Your Honor, is that the Court of Appeals has determined that there's a Scrivener's error in the legislative language, and that as a result of that Scrivener's error, the courts don't need to apply the statutory definition of 274501. So I think that's something.
You want us to clarify whether there is or isn't a Scrivener's error?
Correct. I think
beyond that, what do you want us to do?
I think this court also needs to address the 8th District Court of Appeals' determination that a reasonable employer test should be applied in determining whether or not an employer acts with the belief that injury is...
That's a test that was created by the Court of Appeals.
Correct.
And that, you say, is outside the ambit of what we said in Kaminsky.
I think it's inconsistent with Kaminsky. I think it's inconsistent with prior common law, and I think it's absolutely inconsistent with the express language of the statute.
Mr. Mash, with respect to the idea of two ways of proving employer intent, intentional conduct. What is your position in the way that that part of the statute is written? There are two definitions within the section.
Your Honor.
What is the meaning of that?
Your Honor, it makes complete sense, because when before 2745 was enacted, the common law in this court's decision in Van Fossen, Brady versus Safety Clean, Johnson versus BP Metals, recognized that there are two ways to prove an intentional tort: proof of direct intent and the old substantial certainty standard. In the enacting language of 2745.01, the General Assembly indicated that it wanted to control all torts that existed outside of the exclusive remedy set forth in Section 35, Article 2 of the Constitution. In light of the fact that there was, in the old common law, there were two ways to prove the tort, it makes logical sense that the statute would reference both ways that used to exist to prove the intentional tort. As this court noted in Kaminsky and Stettler, the intent of what the legislature wanted to accomplish in 2745.01 was to curtail the old substantial certainty standard. And the legislature achieved that result by ascribing a narrow definition in subsection B as to how you prove substantial certainty.
So are you saying that the General Assembly has now said there's only one way to prove intentional conduct?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Under subsection A, the only way to prove an intentional tort is by evidence of specific intent.
And the reason for the two definitions is to encompass what this court had done through its prior cases.
Absolutely.
To say that we only have one direct intent.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Because that was the common law that existed, recognized two different ways. The legislature, in its wisdom, identified both old ways of proving it and set a definition of the substantial certainty, which made it clear that under the old substantial certainty standard, you now had to prove deliberate intent. So I think this court was absolutely correct when it recognized in Kaminsky and Stettler that under subsection A, there is only one way to prove an intentional tort, and that's by proof of specific intent.
And the 8th District used reasonable person under which subsection?
Under subsection A, Your Honor. The 8th District didn't look at subsection C at all.
Okay.
And that's where it thought that it could be applied, this reasonable employer test.
Counsel, could you give us an example? Any example, factually, of a case that would stand, get past summary, factually, of an intentional tort by an employer that wouldn't be a felony?
Well, under subsection C, that's an easy response, Your Honor, because all the employee would have to show is that there was a removal of a safety guard. That's not a felony.
Well, I'm talking about the other part of the act.
Well, again, subsection C recognizes torts that exist outside of that. An example of, and I've never, as I sit here, I can't analyze because I don't have the felony statute in front of me and I haven't done it, but an example that I can think of standing here that would potentially come within the purview of subsection A and raise a genuine issue of fact would be a situation where perhaps an employer observes an employee working in an area of the machinery that's unprotected and that's dangerous. And with that knowledge and without advising the employee, turns around and cycles the machine. At that point in time, if we look at the standard that this court talked about under the Allstate Campbell case, the conduct is so entwined with the resulting harm that the harm is essentially a necessary result of that conduct. I think that kind of a circumstance would raise a genuine issue of material fact as it relates to trying to prove a tort under A. And I think this court was correct when it recognized that 2745.01 curtails the old in tort, doesn't do away with it, and most significantly, the curtailing of the intentional tort under A, it makes sense by virtue of the fact that that tort exists under the exclusive remedy of workers' compensation.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is it seems like your position is that you almost agree with my dissent that leads off the Court of Appeals opinion that the legislature essentially wiped out intentional tort.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, your dissent ignores subsection C in its entirety. which recognizes an intentional tort with the removal of the
safety guard. Yeah, but we weren't dealing with that in that case.
You were dealing with the constitution of the entire statute at that point in time. And as to whether or not there can be circumstances that could arise under fact patterns where one could be an intentional tort or a genuine issue of fact of an intentional tort in A and not be a felony, I'm not prepared to address that situation, Your Honor. I see I've used up my time, and at this point I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Grant.
Yes. May it please the Court, David Grant for appellee Bruce Hudak. Some of the comments just made do highlight the issues before this court, and that is Kaminsky and Stetter did decide that this statute was constitutional. This court also has decided that this statute curtails the common law but does not abolish it. So the facts of this case are presented to the court to tell us what the statute means, how it applies.
Is there an unintended Scrivener error in the statute, in your view, or is that a figment of the Court of Appeals?
We are not making that argument. We have not made that argument yet, and I'm not making it today.
If that is the basis of the determination of the Court of Appeals, why shouldn't we reverse it?
The Court of Appeals decision does mention a Scrivener's error. We do not believe that is the basis upon which the court ultimately decided the case.
That was what Mr. Mash was telling us.
He did say that.
All right.
What the Court of Appeals...
What's your response to his argument that that is the basis of their opinion? What do you think the basis of the opinion is in the 8th District?
We believe the basis of the opinion of the 8th District is that Judge Rocco looked at the totality of the circumstances here, the objective facts, to say that here there is evidence to go to a jury for the jury to decide if there has been sufficient intent established under the statute, because the statute does give us two means of proving intent, and it's not just this direct intent.
I understand, I appreciate that argument, and I get it. But does that square with Kaminsky, the way we've articulated the statute? It seems as though the Court of Appeals sort of ignored our holding.
I believe what we pull from Kaminsky is, A, the statute is constitutional on the grounds raised in that case. But Kaminsky was not, from our reading, a factually determinative outcome. What I mean by that is the facts of Kaminsky did not seem to control what happened with the outcome. The facts were that Rose Kaminsky took it upon herself to do this. She looked for a supervisor to perform this task of reloading the coil. She was doing this. The coworker said, I'm not sure we need to do this. She was taking it upon. The facts of that case do not square with the statute itself. The statute gives us these two means of proving intent. And if we're left with a statute that says you have to prove it by the defendant's own admission, then Justice Pfeiffer is correct. You're never going to have a case. That would never allow a case to come forward because you could simply avoid liability by providing a self-serving statement that we didn't intend it after the fact.
If we agree with your view, do we have to say that the failure to provide is the same as removing? Do we have to get that far?
That's under subparagraph C. And the way that we look at the statute is paragraph A is the lead-in introduction that within that gives us two key terms, intent to injure or belief that injury is substantially certain to occur. The belief that injury is substantially certain to occur is further defined by paragraph B, and the intent to injure is further defined by or explained by paragraph C as one example of how you could prove that, through inferred intent. Because paragraph C shows us that the General Assembly intended that you're not going to be able to prove these cases by the employer's own admission. You have to look at the objective facts. Same thing with the use of the term substantial certainty, and then the General Assembly's further definition of that to mean deliberate intent to cause harm. Again, how do you ever prove that? We have, in criminal law, the defendants rarely take the stand in their own defense. You prove what their mindset was at the time an act was committed through objective facts, through other witnesses. Often, Actions speak louder than words. You cannot rely solely on the defendant. And again,
but wouldn't the legislature have known if they have removal that failure to provide would be the same thing? That's the problem I have with the argument under C. It says deliberate removal. Nowhere does it mention failure to provide. And presumably the legislature, and if they were dealing with this court's precedent, would have known that if they had intended to include failure to provide as a way to have relief under subsection C.
Correct. There are cases where there may be a clear-cut guard that had been removed, taken, set aside, taken out of service. Under a subsection C argument, you're right, that would be a clear-cut. However, we believe the facts of this case still present a jury question, and that's important for us to understand, is that this is a case decided at a summary judgment level. It was not a jury verdict, and that's all the appellee is saying is
counsel,
this.
Do you take issue with the fact that the tow motor operator was informed that your client was going to be operating and working in the area, and they would be simultaneously occupying the same area?
Yeah. When you look at, again, the totality of the circumstances here, the employer directives that were put into place to order Mr. Hudak, in contravention of his medical restriction, to do this task, to go down this dark, narrow alleyway, aisleway, to also, at the same...
I think that this was light-duty work. Is that your first...
It was light-duty, however, it still violated his medical restrictions of lifting and bending. And then to, at the same time, order the tow motor operator to continue doing his task, which is on a given shift hundreds of times up and down the aisles of this plant, including down these narrow, dark alleys with a side loader that looks like a forklift, but you travel sideways. So his focus, his direction of facing is toward the side of the aisles, not toward the direction of travel. He's told to do this task as quickly as you can. He also...
But when you go through all those facts would have worked prior to Kaminsky and prior to the statute, because they all seem to tend to substantial certainty. And when you read the Court of Appeals opinion, it's written like a dissenting brief to Kaminsky. They clearly don't like Kaminsky. They clearly try to find a way around Kaminsky and get back to some version of substantial certainty. And that's the problem I have with... What do we do with this? Because we have a Court of Appeals that clearly doesn't like our opinion, clearly is trying to find a way around it, and the only way around it is to get back to a substantial certainty standard by a back door rather than the plain language of Kaminsky and the statute.
And you raise a good point. Our position is not to criticize Kaminsky. It is what we feel to be clear, that it's constitutional. It's not factually determinative, though, as I was saying earlier. And we feel that what we are arguing here is that there are two standards, that the two means of proving intent, the facts of this case do provide enough for a jury to consider whether there has been proven deliberate intent by the employer through objective means. Again, you need to prove
deliberate intent to injure another.
Correct.
Is that what you're saying, that the facts that are presented to the trial court were sufficient to show intent to injure another?
What we have here is that something you rarely, if ever, see is the tow motor operator, within a few days before this event, foreshadowed this exact event happening to the plant manager. He said, if somebody's down that aisle and I'm doing these picks, you know, don't you want me to move my work around so I don't have to go down the aisles? He said, the manager said, don't worry, they'll get out of your way. They're not going to get out of their way. The aisle is too narrow. There's no room to squeeze your body against the rack and let the tow motor slide by. It's just not going to happen. In this case, again, we are arguing both intent under the proof of deliberate intent under paragraph B, or alternatively, the jury could find intent under a guard removal. Again, you need to look at all of the facts. Any one of these facts taken in isolation, and if that was all the case presented, I would be the first to admit that you might not have enough here to get to that. But you need to look at all of the facts. The totality of the objective facts here demonstrate that the employer's intent was present for
this. When we talk about deliberate intent, Is that the same thing as that the employer wanted the employee to be injured? And if not, why not?
I don't believe that's the case. Deliberate implies that there was a consideration behind it. And we feel in this case there is the consideration given the testimony that this was brought up to the manager and he just kind of didn't.
Well, if you deliberately intend to do something, you want it to happen, right? And so in this case, would it be fair to say is that what you're claiming, that the employer wanted the employee to be injured?
An actor is presumed to have intended the natural outcomes, probable consequences of his volitional acts. And we're saying here, when you look at the facts, it is enough for a jury to presume that given the facts presented, it's permissible to presume what the employer's actual intent was. You can't, again, rely.
And you're arguing that the combination of all of these shows the employer wanted the employee to be injured?
Again, the statute language doesn't say wanted. It says deliberate intent. How that applies in a given set of facts, the General Assembly didn't give us that exact answer. But the terms deliberate intent appear to tell us that it requires some awareness of a risk and still proceeding in the face of that
risk. Isn't that more of a negligence standard, even maybe a gross negligence standard, as opposed to deliberate intent?
Again, if you were looking at one sole fact in this case, I would not disagree with you that maybe taking one sole fact on its own might only be negligence or gross negligence. But when you look at the combination of all the facts here, the employer directives setting this train in motion for this injury to occur, being told this injury is likely to occur, is going to happen if we keep going up and down this aisle. Getting back to the Chief Justice questions about forgetting to go down this aisle, you know, using a safety cone at the end is very much like driving down a highway with a construction crew doing road work. You wouldn't dream of having the construction crew there doing this road work without cones out. The cones don't stop a vehicle from crashing through and into the construction zone. What they do is alert drivers and tell them to stay away from this area, much like a cone would do. If you're not using a cone, you're not alerting, you're not reminding this worker who has a lot on his plate on a given shift going up and down these aisles.
But you don't argue against the testimony that the tow motor operator was informed that your client would be in the proximity of his operation?
There has been that testimony. I don't dispute the fact that there's testimony to that effect. Correct.
Okay, so I guess I'm trying to – is it that the employer deliberately intended them to work in – to do the activities that they were both engaged in, or the employer deliberately intended that this – activity would cause an injury?
In this case, given the facts, I would say that it actually is both. The employer intended both of these workers to do their respective tasks at the same time in the same place, knowing that doing that, you are going to cause this injury. And it's not like we're...
Wait a minute. You're saying deliberately intending to cause the injury then as a result of putting these two individuals and their machinery in this proximity?
That is our argument. Again, that a jury should be able to hear that evidence and come to its own conclusion. If this goes to
and
trial...
And the very fact that they were together in this proximity is what you base your case on.
Yes. Again, all of the employer directives taken into account say that the employer had awareness. And again, I keep coming back to this because I think it's crucial to the facts of this case. Not only is the employer telling both of these workers to do this to do their respective tasks at the same time in the same area, but this employer had also just been warned of this very event happening and still gives these directives in the face of that.
So even if we – let's assume that the employer was warned. Back to Justice Cupp's question, isn't that a negligence? How do you get to the intentional tort? Do you have evidence that would establish that they intended this injury to occur? Had there been this kind of injury in the past with this company? Is there some way we're supposed to treat the OSHA violation as showing the intentional tort?
Okay. I'd like to answer your question, then yield a minute or two to counsel for amicus. Again, the facts of this case show that it is more than just a reckless event that happened. You have employer directives putting this into action, putting this all into play.
Let's assume it might be negligence, but how does it go to the next higher level of intentional tort?
Again, the facts, including the testimony that the manager who put this into play had been told, this is what's going to happen. If you have us do this, this is what's going to happen. And he, in the face of that, still proceeds to tell them, go ahead and do it anyways, essentially. So I see my time is up. If there's no other questions, what we'd like the court to do is to affirm the 8th District's reversal of summary judgment in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Flowers, you've got 10 seconds.
Let me welcome you back to the podium. You were here yesterday, Mr. Flowers.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And you were arguing us with construing the plain meaning of the statute. Now, is that the same position you want us to We don't have to answer that question, Paul.
It did occur to me as I was in bed last night that there might be some tension there. But really, I will say this in 10 seconds or less. If there was a plain meeting here, I'm sure Judge Rocco and the Court of Appeals would have followed it. It just isn't there. And I don't read this opinion, the Hudak opinion, is defying Kaminsky and Stetterer. I think what Judge Rocco said is, look, they found it constitutional because there's something left. And it's now up to us to decide what is left of the intentional tort in Ohio. And this is really the best and most pragmatic solution. I really was intrigued by Mr. Mash's argument that, hey, this is akin to these inferential tort cases that we have in insurance cases, where we infer the intent to injure from the conduct itself, that it's so dangerous that they must have known. And that's really, I think, what Judge Rocco is saying here, that we're going to look at what a reasonable person, reasonable employer would have understood under those circumstances. If it's just so outrageous that they must have known, a jury can consider that and find in favor of the plaintiff.
That sounds like an entirely different statute, though, than is written here. And it seems like the General Assembly has tried to say, you know, accidents that happen in the workplace, even negligence, even cases such as this are going to be covered by workers' compensation, and we're going to follow the Constitution that says the employer is not liable in those situations. And only when there's specific intent to injure do we have intentional conduct, intentional tort, which is outside of the workers' comp statute.
Well, I agree with you. Negligence is definitely out. I mean, it always has been.
And isn't this gross negligence at best?
No, if it's gross negligence, there's no recovery. I agree with that as well. I think that this is so outrageous that you've got somebody working in close proximity to this tow motor where the operator can't see him. A catastrophe was inevitable. I mean, it was going to happen. This is one where you can infer the intent to injure because of the circumstances. It's just what Mr. Mash was talking about.
How do you factor in the simple fact that the operator of the vehicle forgot that he was warned?
Well,
he was warned and he forgot. Isn't that just negligence? Did he deliberately forget? What was his role in this intent category? Because if he had remembered, he was instructed, and if he had remembered, there would have been no accident, correct?
Well, my response to that is that the operator is not the defendant here. The employer should have known that you cannot trust an operator who's preoccupied with other duties to make sure he doesn't hit the worker next to
him. Your basis of intent is I warn the operator, but I shouldn't expect my employees to follow my warnings.
Oh, employees forget warnings all the time.
I mean, that's the basis inevitable. Of the intent, is that my employee might forget the warning and therefore I intended this accident to happen?
OSHA does not allow people working around tow motors as long as you advise the operator that they're there and tell them to be careful. That's not a defense. The people forget those all the time. That's why we have these regulations. But just going back to answering Judge Lanziger's question, the problem with saying that this means specific intent and nothing more is that that is not what the statute says. Subsection A preserves the two-part test that Mr. Mash talked about, specific intent and substantial certainty, and then we have this new definition in subpart B of substantial certainty, but it's still a two-part test. There's
What's the difference standards. Between deliberate intent and specific intent then?
Ah, right. That's the nub of it, because specific intent has always been very clear. You intended the injury. The second part, so it was substantial certainty. Now we're trying to define substantial certainty, mean deliberate intent. you plug that definition into subpart A, it doesn't make any sense because it becomes the belief that the employer deliberately intended to cause the injury. The employer has to believe that they intended, which grammatically is incongruous.
So you're rejecting Mr. Mash's explanation as implausible then?
Not just implausible, but contrary to the terms of the statute. The one thing that is clear in subpart A is there's a two-part test. There's two standards there. That's the way it was before. They have preserved that. The question Judge Rocco struggled with, and I've been arguing in front of Judge Rocco for a long time, he's not one to make new law when he doesn't have to, was what is this part, this second substantial, certain, deliberate intent, what are we to do with that? And what he came up with, I think, makes the most sense. When we look at belief, which is a word that's still in there, we're going to say, what would the reasonable employer have believed under the circumstances? A jury can ask that. And that's really no different than these inferential intent cases that are being referenced. So it's a confusing, confounding statute. I think the 8th District did the best job they could with it and made a sensible opinion, and we'd ask you to affirm.
Do you find this to be a Scrivener error?
No.
Okay.
That's a colorful term, I think, you know, that he used, and I think it's just the product of legislative debate and compromise.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Mash.
Briefly summarize, in answer to your question, Justice O'Donnell, Judge Rocco, writing the opinion, specifically said, our preference is to believe that the dissonant paragraph B is a Scrivener's error. That was the finding of the appellate court. That was the means by which the 8th District Court of Appeals ignored the statutory language set forth in subsection B, and that was the means by which the court came up with this new reasonable employer test. And to answer your question, Judge Lanzinger, I believe that, in fact, the court has sought to avoid the holdings in Kaminsky and Stettler. I think this reasonable employer test is a commonly used as a product of examining negligence. And to put a reasonable employer test in the context of this intentional tort, which is designed to examine the mindset, the conscious mindset of the employer, and make a determination as to whether or not the employer acted with specific intent to cause injury, is absolutely improper. And it's a way to get around what the intent and purpose of the legislature's generation of 2745.01. And finally, with this whole argument about two different meanings of intent to injure and deliberate intent, and this argument on deliberate intent, you know, let's look at what the court says, or let's look at what the legislature says when it defines substantial certainty in subsection B. It says, an employer acts with deliberate intent to cause the injury. The deliberate intent is linked to causing the injury. It's not deliberate intent to act. So in order to prove, I respectfully submit that this court absolutely got it right in Kaminsky and Stettler, that to prove a tort under subsection A, the plaintiff bears the burden of establishing specific intent to cause injury. Subsection C creates a limited defined number of cases where if you have a deliberate removal of a safety guard, the employee is entitled to a rebuttable presumption of prejudice. So, and that, in my mind, that makes sense because, you know, a product manufacturer has obviously, in designing a product, has made the assessment that the machine merits having safety equipment. It makes sense that you wouldn't want employers removing safety equipment that had been designed to be implemented in the machine. It's unequivocal that in this case there was no removal of existing safety equipment anywhere. Plaintiff faults us for not putting safety cones to prevent the side loader coming down. That's not a deliberate removal of an existing safety equipment. It's also clear in this case there's no misstatement of the existence of toxic substances. This is not, on its face, a subsection C case. The trial court was correct, and the Court of Appeals was correct when it didn't even address that argument. We respectfully submit that the trial court was absolutely correct in its granting of summary judgment in that there was no genuine issue of material fact that rises to the level necessary to establish a tort under subsection A. One last statement, and I'm finished. I just want to make sure that the court, there's been some statements in the appellate's briefs that ThyssenKrupp instructed the operator of the side lift operator to operate at maximum speed. That, in fact, is not correct. When Mr. Krasek was asked that question, he said, were you instructed to operate at maximum speed? He said no. His testimony was at the time he's operating, he thought he was operating safely. He thought he was operating in a way that wouldn't hurt anybody. He just had forgotten the instruction, the warning that Mr. Hudak would be down there, and unfortunately did not see Mr. Hudak or did not see the scissor jack that Mr. Hudak was using in order to reach the higher levels of the aisle.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.